tsunami's back, bitches.
Took you long enough.
This has been an experience we will never forget.
This ain't no time to go all mushy.
Don't lecture me. I've waited long enough.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 462 of the Tsunami Escape Podcast. I'm C. Kohler, and with me tonight, as usual, is Seda.
Hello.
And Crocodile.
Good evening.
The only real news we wanted to touch on briefly here, it's not really news, but it's more of a confirmation, is that, as we've talked about before, the upcoming Adult Swim / Tsunami series, Rooster Fighter, will be premiering on May 14th.
March 14th.
March, you said May.
Oh, I said May. Okay, March 14th at midnight. So we've looked ahead at the Adult Swim schedule, and it does appear that it's going to be replacing Bleach, because Bleach will have its final episode the weekend before that. So the new lineup at that point will be The block will lead off with Rooster Fighter, and then we will probably get Primal after that, because there will still be two more episodes of that to go.
Yep. We keep saying Gatadan Season 2 has got to come eventually, right? They already teased it, and we always get these other shows. So maybe that'll be Primal's replacement.
Right. And I feel stuff will fall into the rerun. I don't know how the rerun slots are going. I don't know what episode Daima they're on. I could see Bleach falling into the rerun slot at some point, and that could stick around for a good while. And then, Primal might move down or something. But yeah, Primal's not long after. So that would be the next opening. Then
that's
I guess
point.
There wouldn't be any openings for a while. I'm assuming Rooster Fighter is a 12 to 13 episode series. So after Primal, there wouldn't be another opening for like 3 months, basically.
Yeah, because Tokyo Revengers and Blue Lock might stick around for a while. They're multiple
they could go through the end of the year, probably.
No. Okay. Get used to them.
I'm trying.
Same.
Let's get into the block, and we'll begin, of course, with Primal. Primal, Season 3, Episode 5, The Dead Cast No Shadow. So before I begin the one down, this basically overview of this episode is that this is an episode about the reunion of Zombie Sphere with Mira and Fang. So Mira kind of tries talking to Spear, but he can only really kind of yell back and, and he's not really able to very well communicate. He does try to kind of pantomime what's been going on with him, but it's not really clear.
Yeah, there's definitely a bit of a language barrier between Zombie and whatever language Mira speaks.
Yeah, and so throughout this like sequence, Mira tries to like for a minute or a couple of times throughout the episode try to like communicate with Spear, but Fang is just not having it. Like Fang is just like, go away. I'm just going to yell at you or roar at you whenever I can. So
I'm kind of surprised at how well Mira's taking it. Like her ex-husband, well, I guess they weren't married, but basically their husband, they were, basically a couple. So like her ex is back. The father of her unborn child is back. He's undead zombie. And rather than like freaking the fuck out, like the other villagers who are just like losing their shit, she's kind of calm, collected, trying to like take one step at a time, see what's going on, see if she can reach him. So I'm really surprised how well she's taking it. She's always not happy about it, but she's like taking it oddly well.
Yeah.
The other two remaining villagers are pretty much just like completely scared of Spear, trying to ward him off, doing all sorts of like incantations and things. But Mira's kind of cool. Like you said, she sits with him, tries to communicate. She's off put, but then there's always like she gets these little moments of like, oh, maybe there's something there, maybe he can be redeemed or brought back. She tries drawing on the ground to try to communicate him that way. He doesn't do anything, but then later she sees him trying to draw, but it's just like a big blotch, like he's not really drawing anything.
Yeah,
yeah,
it's random. Like, yeah, there are multiple times where she thinks she's reaching him, but not really, but kind of like, you can see that in Spear's head, he's trying to piece things together slowly. Mm-hmm. And of course, we see later in episode, there's something coming back there, kind of. But it's just basically kind of like a lot of Mira thinks she's breaking through, but not really, because he's a zombie still. So his brain's kind of fucked up. But
yeah, even the episode basically ends on that same idea.
So when she gets frustrated, she goes to kind of just sit back by with Fang and the little Fanglings. And Fang is just, for the whole episode, even all the way to the end, just constantly just giving him the side eye, just kind of like growling and being like, get away, protecting Mira.
Probably worth noting that the Fanglings at times actually do seem to embrace Spear.
Yeah, like, and totally they're, do
they're,
by
they're,
the end.
They're being friendly, or at least friendlier. But yeah, Fang the whole time is hostile, basically.
When we come back, you know, the rescue party decides to head off to try to continue finding that kid, and Spear just sort of follows them. We get kind of a little montage of this where, you know, he just keep looking back, and he's back there kind of slowly trudging along. And then we kind of get into the action part of the episode. He and Fang end up chasing a warthog that they surprise.
They try to hunt it down.
Yeah,
it's like they're like competing with each other. Like, I'm gonna get the warthog. No, I am. You know.
Yeah. So. And then we run into a bunch of baboons, and they end up attacking and stealing and taking Mira,
and killing the other two guys. They're dead now.
Yeah, just literally ripping their throats out. Fang and Spear go off. They catch the boar, or rather, Spear catches the boar first with a spear. And then, you know, then they hear a commotion as they're arguing about who gets to keep the kill. And that's that point that the mad baboons just come out of nowhere, basically snatch, like, just rip the throats out of the male villagers, and then snatch Mira and just start running off into the trees doing some Naruto jumping or you know, whatever. But it's you know, they're apes, so they're moving through trees as apes would. But for some reason, Naruto came to mind, for better or worse. I'm just, I guess, too weeb-pilled, but...
Well, there's a part in this episode where, like, Fang is trying to, or Spear, excuse me, is trying to jump from the tree branches and then, like, falls and then gets back up and falls again and gets back up. It's kind of like
knocked down,
weird commenty or weird comedy almost. Yeah. Like, he just got up and he's like a zombie, so it, like, doesn't hurt him. He just kind of, like, falls and just, like, immediately just tries again.
It was kind of funny because Fang and her children obviously can't jump up into the trees. So they're trying to chase off the baboons, and they're looking at Fang, keeps going back up into the trees to try to chase, and he's, you know, fucking up. Eventually he gets it and, you know, chases the baboons down, but it takes a good minute or 90 seconds of Spear flailing about before he...
Yeah, I have no problem with his action, but it just kind of stuck out to me as, like, you know, kind of a little bit of levity in this otherwise kind of, you know, almost like stressful episode.
Two villagers got murdered. Mira is heavily pregnant. I'm like looking at what's going on, kind of wincing and scared because, like, one errant fall and she could get a miscarriage realistically. Obviously, that's not going to happen. Genny's not that fucked up. We know that she survives. You know, Spear's child gets born. So we know she's safe, but you can't help but look at what's happening, being like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. Like, there's just a little bit of that, at least for me.
Going back a second, like before this whole sequence, it was kind of amusing to me where, like, Mira is trying to communicate with Spear, and like it's almost as if like several minutes in she has a realization, like, oh yeah, I'm pregnant, and tries to show Spear their child. It was amusing to me because it like felt like she had to like remember that she was pregnant. I don't know if anyone else felt that way, but it is like the fact that it didn't come up immediately. Yeah.
We mentioned it on the previous episode, but it is like, he is so pregnant to the point that he shouldn't probably be on this expedition.
Yeah.
But of course, it's a different time. She's clearly like the leader or one of the highest ranked people in the village. So like, yeah, she shouldn't like be here. She should be at home resting. But again, it's, we're talking how whatever BC, you know, you got to do what you got to do. It's fantasy, yada, yada, yada. But
yeah. Well, eventually Spear does end up rescuing Mira, but they both sort of fall to the ground. And when he gets back up, his kind of arm falls off. But she's grateful and ends up stitching his arm back onto him. And because Zombie Spear had protected and rescued Mira, she's cool with him. The little Fanglings are cool with him. But Fang herself still kind of ends the episode with just a like growl and is mad, you know.
Upset. Yeah, and I teed this up earlier. The episode ends with Mira giving her name again. And then Spear just yells back.
Yeah.
Like,
hasn't made any progress.
For a moment, you wonder, like, will he say his name? Like, will there be a hint of, you know, humanity there? And then he just yells. And it's like, oh, maybe not yet.
Yeah. I think overall, like, the story of this episode was pretty well written. It's hard to say writing, but you know what I mean. Like, the
Primal's a show very light on dialogue, but we get the point you mean, yeah. It does a lot to communicate without many words.
They came back, you know, the theme of the episode about the communication starts and ends the same way. It was very nice. So, yeah, that's a pretty good episode, I guess. Any other thoughts about this?
It almost goes without saying, but as I was watching this episode, just like a lot of the art, especially like the background art and colors, are very good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so there are definitely some, like, it was very good at setting tone. And like also impending, like both some levity as we kind of discussed earlier, but also impending dread. Like I do remember the scene where Mira got dropped off at the baboon's nest and she fought off the baby baboons with the skull and bone, the bone and the headpiece she found. Like she's using the skeleton of some animal as a makeshift sword and shield or club and shield. And that was kind of a pretty impressive moment, but it was also kind of like in this dark kind of like grimy lit nest. And so that was kind of a good execution of Dread and Peril. But yeah, I thought, I mean, it's Primal, so it's always kind of a good-looking show. I definitely thought this episode kind of stood out in terms of some of the background art and kind of how the art was able to set kind of the tone for the particular moments and fit well. I also feel the, going back early in the episode, when Fang and Spear kind of fighting over the warthog. That reminded me a lot of the bickering that Fang and Spear used to have back when they first met, like earlier in season one. So I feel like also kind of redoing this because Fang has to be reacclimate to Spear, who's now like undead. And Fang is very justifiably concerned, upset, disgusted, scared. So they kind of have to kind of do like a retraining arc, so to speak, or reacclimation arc. So it just I just thought it made sense for them to do this. And I thought it was kind of pretty well executing, kind of brought me back to earlier times when, again, the two characters kind of first met, they're going through those first few episodes, getting used to each other. And then you kind of see this going on here again, because they just basically have to, the reset button's been set for that, or pushed for that relationship. So they're trying to bring it back as best they can.
Okay. Well, let's move on to Bleach. Bleach, the Thousand-Year Blood War, Core 3, Episode 11, Shadows Gone. So, after a brief flashback where we see a very young Shunsui and his brother and his brother's girlfriend, we see that Shunsui in current time is being hit by a beam from Lily, and it is a powerful wound. And this is when we get to see that Lily did survive the last attack and now has a whole new form because he is God's instrument or something like that.
Yeah, his head just regrows and gets replaced with a snake, bird, chimera thing.
This is not where I expected this Quincy character to go. Like, oh, he's like a general, like, beret, like, sniper man. And now he's like, I am God. Like, oh, okay.
Yeah, it definitely feels like he had a personality transplant when he activated his Bankai. Feels like a bit of a non sequitur.
Yeah, like, when he was a sniper guy, I never really felt like he had, like, this God persona or complex. But now he suddenly is calling himself, like, a God. And that's, like, a big part of, like, his powers. And I guess even how he's defeated, ultimately. And just, I don't know, right. Just like this is the same character? Oh, sure, fine.
Yeah, my assumption is this form is some reference to Judeo-Christian mythology just because he's the trumpeter. That's clearly like a Christian motif.
Yeah. Like, yes, so that's an angel thing.
I don't, I'm not familiar with exactly what Christian angel or creature or whatever he's riffing off of, but it clearly has to be Judeo-Christian as opposed to, you know, like Japanese or some Eastern tradition or whatever. So, but it is very much out of left field. He wasn't like a priest character or a nun character. I mean, obviously not a nun character. He's not a woman, but you know what I mean? He wasn't like a priestly character or very religious kind of seeming character or anything of that sort. He was just, he was a sniper dude, kind of militaristic general, kind of focused, kind of no, you know, business, no fuss, no muss, kind of get the job done.
Yeah.
Made sense for his role. And just now he's all like, I am God's messenger. All bow down before me, and for blessed is he who comes from roof,
yeah,
out of our womb, and you know, say our Father and Hail Mary and so on and whatnot. But yeah.
Anyways, he's still alive.
He's alive. He's got a really long neck, and he has an owl's head, and it just looks dumber than he ever.
Also, his head can like change shape and size. Also, I guess.
Yeah, and he's like he has like vertical eyelids.
Yeah, and he looks around. He does it the most unnecessarily weird way possible, turning his head into a giant disc.
And yeah, good animation though on the head transformation.
Yeah, I guess. Anyway, he's about to do another serious hit to Shunsui, and that's when Nanao arrives, and Nanao is here to help him. And then we get kind of like more slash backstory explanation about the Issei family. Shunsui explains to Nanao the Issei family, particularly the Issei family curse. She is from the Issei family.
Well, he more explains to the audience, I would say.
Well, yeah, but if any of this was, like, if we knew anything about Nanao before this, I totally forgot it. Like, if they said anything about her character or anything about her background, I did not know it. Maybe they showed it, but I had forgotten it.
We knew a little bit about her background, but a lot of this is kind of new for the first time. Like, we kind of knew they had a familiar relationship, but it wasn't entirely clear what it was. And now it's like, okay, he's her, she's his niece. Like, that makes sense very clear.
He's basically his uncle, her uncle.
Yeah.
And I think I even before mentioned, like I think even maybe in a previous episode I mentioned, or like, are they romantically interested in each other? And so now I'm like, well, I hope not.
He's not basically her uncle. He is her uncle. Cause
that's what
her,
I meant. Yeah.
Yeah, not basically, but like just straight up is. But
yeah, and another thing we've learned is that he's never given her Zanpakuto, and he had a good reason not to, because he was afraid if he gave it to her that it would, you know, continue this family curse and this whole issue. And but she's strong enough now, and that he's kind of in dire straits to the point where he's like, she's like convinces him. She's like, you keep trying to protect me, but I don't want you to protect me anymore. I want to protect you. I'm going to do this. I don't care about the curse. Just give it to me. And then he ends up giving her this Zanpakuto, which is called Shinken Hakyoken. And real quick, before I move on, before she uses it, before she goes into the battle, Shunsui summons something, some person to give her the sword. Yes. What is that?
His sword has two souls in it. I think it's because that's what's even part, like, so we described before how these Bankai, or like Shinsui's Bankai, was first non-canon, and then Kubo liked it so much he made it canon. But even back in when it was first created in that non-canon arc, his Bankai had two aspects to her, this like larger, you know, mature, voluptuous woman, and this like little kind of younger girl. Those are two aspects of it, the same Bankai.
Yeah, this is actually something I was wondering earlier, because earlier in this arc, Ichigo got like two Zanpakutos, and they kind of argue it because of his, you know, mutt status or whatever. He has two Zanpakutos. I'm like, wait, at the time, like, Shunsui kind of also has two Zanpakutos, but it's a little different. It's like two parts of the same. Because he's always had two swords, like from the very beginning, he's always had two.
Right. And I think the implication that Nanao's sword, which to be clear, Shinsui has because her mother asked him to take it and hold it and you know, to avoid the whole curse nonsense. So it wasn't necessarily that Shinsui just took it himself, but he was asked to take it by her mother. And so that's why he has a sword. And so like that sword has kind of I'm not sure if it like became part of or just hidden by the other aspect of Shinsui's Bankai, but basically she obviously, the smaller woman pulls the sword out of her skull, basically, to give to Nanao. And like, we've known Nanao since the, Rukia Retrieval Arc, whatever you want to call it. Also, Soul Sight Arc, there we go. Ever since that arc, that was when we first introduced her to Nanao. We've never seen her use a sword. She always used magic and, you know, all, you know, the Hado spells and whatnot. She's never used a sword before. And so this is kind of the explanation for the reason she never used a Zanpakuto is because Shinsui had it, because it's a specifically special sword, has specific special capabilities and that whole curse thing behind it. But it's kind of an explanation for why throughout the entire series she's like the only main Soul Reaper, or like she's obviously a side character but of prominence. She's the only one who's never used a Zanpakuto in battle before, and this is the reason why.
Yeah, they even during the flashback, I forget who's narrating at this point, but younger her is even mentioning like, I never could figure out the Zanpakuto, but I could use Kido really well, so I was basically admitted to the Soul Society based on that alone.
Well, she goes, you know, because Shinsui's in a really dire straits here. He's not in a real good position to fight. So she decides she's going to do it. She takes the sword. Now, this sword has no blade because it is not a sword of a normal type of sword. It's a device specifically for basically fighting against, like, gods, basically. Like,
yeah, wow. It's perfectly suited for this person they're taking on right now.
Totally. At first, Lily's a little... You know, he's a little like, oh, what do you got there? That doesn't even have a blade. It's not going to cut me. It does end up cutting him. He's like, oh, I get it. It only cuts godly things, holy things.
Well, something to that this effect. Is the thing. Lily remarks that the blade, or the not blade, whatever, the sword is so bright, you can barely see it. And then, of course, now explains how the blade, she basically tells them the entirety of how her sword works. Because, of course, this is a Bleach and Shonen. You have to explain entirety of your moveset your opponent before you use it, because of course, she explains that the sword reflects, like, the power of the sword is basically to diffuse and deflect divine energy, and so the fact that a Lily sees the sword is so bright that it's almost blinding, it's reflecting his light, his energy, basically. That's what his sword does, it can reflect that.
Yep.
He tells him this, and then she is able to get a sneak attack on him, cutting off one of his arms, and at that point Lily understands, oh, this looks harmless. It's actually really fucking dangerous. I should use my ultimate attack and finish her off.
Yeah. Before he does that, Nanao is... She does get hurt. She starts bleeding. And she's very frightened. She's never been in the position where she's had to use a sword like this before. She's very frightened. But then Shinsui shows up, kind of teleports behind her, and takes her by the hand and is like, I'm here to help you. Give her courage. And that's when Lily does fire his giant trumpet attack, his super trumpet attack. He shoots it, but of course the power of this special blade just reflects his attack right back at him and ends up killing him. So he defeated himself.
I like the part where he's, after he launches the attack and gets reflected back at him, he goes on to say, oh right, you told me this would happen. Ah, yeah, you said if I attack you, reflect on me, and then I attack you and reflect on me. Ah, interesting. And then he dies. I'm like, you fucking moron. She told you this. Why would you do that? You stupid, dumbass bitch. You get what you deserve.
The moment he started being like, I am a messenger from God and you cannot defeat... I'm like, you're dead, dude. Just shut up. You're dead. You're going to die. Yeah. So, yeah. That's it. That's where the episode ends. Yeah, it was kind of nice, I guess. I didn't know. Again, I kind of watch every Bleach episode like feeling like I needed to know more. It's not like I was confused or anything, but that just I miss out on all the like callbacks because everything to me is new, and so I'm like, oh, okay. But yeah, it's nice. I liked her sword, her new special Bankai bladeless blade, and. I mean, Shunsui's going to survive, right? I mean, isn't he?
I mean, he's just a hole in his chest. You know, that's just a flesh wound in Shonen. Oh, his heart is gone? Whatever. Pish posh.
I mean, he's missing like just several chunks of his body. There's holes like all over him.
Yeah, just put some more band-aids on there. You're good. That's how Shonen works.
I guess. I honestly can't tell. Again, we joke every week about like, how do Soul Reapers even work? We don't know. Yeah. Any other thoughts about this episode?
Yes. So A, the ending, the card for the opening for the episode title was pretty cool, but they've been pretty cool pretty consistently throughout the entire arc. But I especially liked how he kind of was sitting in the middle of the episode title. The shadows are now gone because Lily was casting a light over the course. The entire field has been defeated. And of course, Shinsui is kind of exhausted. So I thought those kind of the shadows are gone kind of cool in that sense. And I was how Nanao and Shinsui kind of emerged from and used shadows, of course, with the entire fight. Shadows has kind of always been his thing, but it was pretty expertly used here as well. I did want to mention, I kind of got in a little, a disagreement with someone in the thread. And of course, I totally respect their opinion. They're kind of describing how Bleach has a tendency to shortchange female characters. Don't give them the credit they're due. An issue that a lot of shonen fall into, that the women don't get to make the kills or get the time in the limelight they deserve, being action heroes they are themselves in these series. I felt I kind of disagreed in this particular context because this did not feel to me like a situation which Shinsui stole Nanao's kill. This to me just showed kind of the mutual kind of respect and support they gave each other. Nanao has typically supported Shinsui over the course of the series, being his lieutenant, his right-hand man or woman, so to speak. So just giving him support in that sense. And obviously she came back to the fight to help him after, obviously she didn't know he was getting his ass beaten, but she obviously came back to help him. And what ended up happening is it was turnaround in the sense that Shinsui was basically defeated. Like, Lily had him dead to rights, now had to come, ask for her sword back, get her sword back, take it. And she was the one who, dealt the final blow, or I guess Lily himself. But, she didn't reflect or counter or whatever. It's still her move. It's still her sword. It's still her ability. And, of course, her being, not a neophyte, but obviously not experienced in a combat in the same way that most of other Soul Reapers are. Not because she's weak. That's just not what she does. She's the egghead, not necessarily the physical brawler. And so, obviously, Shinsui came to support her, but... again, not to take a shine away from her, but she's given him so much support. It's his turn to reciprocate that and give her his support. And so I just thought that kind of instance was not a reflection of Nanao's weakness, but just rather a reflection of the strength of the relationship. And obviously that he was taking the lead and Shinsui was the support. And so it is true, I totally agree, that Bleach has a tendency to shortchange its female characters in a variety of ways. Quite unfortunate, because it does have some pretty cool female characters. But again, a lot of times they don't get their due in terms of fights or prominence or whatnot. But at least I felt this moment was not really an example of that. I thought this was Nao's moment to shine. And I think Shinsui supporting her did not reflect poorly on her or take away anything from her. It was just him doing what was right, what needed to be done, and giving his reciprocated support to, his niece, basically. So I just want to say that I understand if others disagree, and the point that each maybe doesn't do his female characters justice in terms of writing is totally valid, but I just now feel this particular instance was an example of that.
I mean, I agree with you broadly that, Bleach, not talking about Bleach as a whole, but just this specific character, she's always been, a secretary type, which maybe that's inherently a problem, you might argue. I'm not sure. But yeah, I wouldn't expect her to be I'm actually secretly a badass. That would also be weird, just the way that she has been. So I'm fine with this particular instance.
Yeah,
so.
And from my perspective, not knowing, I took this scenario simply as I'm going to help you do what you need to do. I didn't feel in the moment that he was taking over the fight or anything like that. It was just a support role that he was playing. So, okay. Well, let's move on to Blue Lock. Blue Lock, Episode 2, Monster. Guys, there are soccer monsters, as we learn in this episode. So let's learn about them. First up, we see a boardroom meeting of the Japan Football Union. And they're like, oh yeah, our teams suck. But, hey, we do all right. Sales are okay and stuff like that.
We'll call it a merch.
Yeah. But Henri's like, no, no, we need to win. We need to win. She's very passionate about this.
Yeah, in this world, Japan winning the World Cup is the most important thing. That's the goal. That's the only thing that matters in this world.
In a world where soccer is everything.
Yeah, pretty much.
Meanwhile, we cut back to the end of the previous episode where we see that Kira has now been knocked out. He is going to be locked off, and Ego appears on the screen. And Kira's really upset about this, and he's really getting on Ego about, like, well, this is so stupid. I'm getting locked off simply because of a game of tag. Tag has nothing to do with soccer. And then Ego goes into, like, oh, no, you don't understand. There's all these reasons why this game in particular just happens to be the perfect way to find out who's good for soccer. And he kind of goes into that whole spiel.
I will say, to Ego's defense, I mean, I still remain adamant in that the man is a lunatic and is probably a danger to himself and others, and I would not trust him to throw out my garbage. The points he makes here, again, this whole situation is fucking crazy, but the points he makes here about the usefulness of the exercise, I think in some crazy way, like, they make a lot of sense. I think the broader point, the issue is that Kira did have a chance to save himself. He kind of gave up on himself when he got hit. I think Eagle's point about that was pretty valid.
Yeah, like, I mean, he was just bullshit. But it's basically he's saying that you're not good enough. You're not going to be good enough for this program because you're not willing to. You hesitate. You can't hesitate. That's a weakness in this program. So that's why he's out. Basically.
Yeah.
One thing I want to note before we go any further is we saw the opening to the show. And Kira is not in it, or at least if he is, he's not prominent in it.
He is, but he's not prominent, but he is in there.
Oh, I barely recognized him. But one person who's in the opening quite a bit, I noticed, was Bachura. Guy with, like, the two-toned hair. And he was actually pretty prevalent in this episode, too. Like, oh, you know, this is one of those characters that, like, from the first episode alone, it's hard to maybe get a grasp, like, how important or significant is this character? And, like, oh, probably pretty important, how much he's in the opening and also what he does in the he is very prominent in this second episode as sort of
I'm sure there's a ton of Isagi and Bakshiro fan fiction out there if you care to look for it. I do not, but I'm sure it's out there.
There was a part of this episode where their, like, faces are, like, they're, like, scowling at each other. And I can't help but think of, like, the meme, like, now kiss, you know? And so I'm sure people have drawn that.
The show's face game was on point this episode. I don't know if it's going to continue to be on point moving forward. But the angry faces, the silly faces, the shocked faces, all those kinds of things, it was on point. I have to give props for that, at least.
That was going to be my next point. Yeah, the faces are extreme, and I'm not against that. I'm like, fine, give me something in this show, and that's one thing it's definitely leaning into is the exaggerated facial expressions of these characters as they react to these situations, which I like that. They've been kind of doing it since the first episode too, with, like, there's, like, this, oh, every once in a while, like, their eyes will glow blue, you know, and all this stuff.
That's the monster.
That may very, very well be. So Ego goes on, once Kira's out, he explains, okay, now you guys are Team Z, and now there's 11 of you left, and which is just happens to be the amount of players there would be on a soccer team, and that they have now passed the entrance exam. And so then we get, like, a montage of just sort of daily life stuff showing, like, how life works in Blue Lock, where, like, depending on your rank, you get, you know, that's the quality of the food you're going to get or the quality of the bedding you're going to get and all these other aspects. You get perks for being better, basically.
And, like, the two lowest ranked people, which is the name is Igarashi. He's, like, the short haired guy, and Isagi. They get, like, pickled radishes or something, and natto, which is, like, a soybean thing.
Isn't that a nasty thing that Japanese people tend to like, to gatekeep people? At least that's a joke I hear.
I've never had natto, but I know people say that it's, like, an acquired taste at best, but in, like, it's smelly and doesn't taste good and or whatever. And they make a joke that, like, you know, no one's gonna steal our food. Like, someone, right, they show I, someone I did like stealing. That. They show someone stealing, like, I forget what it was, sushi
dumplings,
or something.
And, like, from another character.
Yeah, or dumplings. Like, but yeah, the two lowest ranked characters get crappy food.
Yeah, so like the idea here being it's like a kind of mental reinforcement for the program.
Incentive, basically, to get you want better, do better.
Ego is, you know, he's planned this entire thing to try to create the ultimate player, and it's going to require you to be strong and you know, get stronger. So anyway.
And also worth mentioning that they call this group of, I guess, 11 characters now that we know, this is Team Z. And then other team letters. Oh, okay. Yeah, and so like this is our, I guess this is our main cast, I assume. I'm assuming we'll get to know characters from other teams, but for now, this is our, like,
right,
the characters we know.
And we'll learn a little bit more after the break about the namings of the teams and so forth. So anyway, before that, though, Isaki, he does run into Bachira, and he's like, hey, you know, why did you pass me the ball? And this is kind of like afterwards, like this is after the whole montage, and Isagi can't go to sleep. He's just too energized. He wants to practice. He runs into Bachira, who's also up and about wanting to practice. Asks him, why did you pass the ball? And that's when Bachira says, oh, well, you see, I've got a monster inside me, and my monster told me to do it. And he's talking a little weird here, and we kind of see the monster is represented by this sort of CG, like, beast.
And this whole time, Isagi is like, this guy is crazy.
Yeah.
I'm just hoping that there's a psychiatrist on campus to, you know, help with this. If people, if all the students have like a schizophrenia or some shit,
I think it's the opposite. I think Ego would not want that. I think he wants these guys to go crazy and become like monsters. So, all right, when we come back from the commercial break, Bachira continues to explain how he's always had this monster inside him that's telling him how to play, and that's how he gets good. And sometimes he does things he doesn't think he would normally do, but he does, whenever he follows or is forced to follow the whims of his monster, he ends up, you know, kind of making great plays. That's when Ego comes back in, and he's like, hey, everybody getting new rankings, and all the numbers on their shirts change. And everyone's kind of excited that their numbers have gotten better, but it's only because, you know, a bunch of people have been disqualified now.
Yeah, that was pretty funny. They were so happy. Yeah, we won 25. We went up 25 spots. Hooray! And the Eagles, like, 25 people were eliminated, so here are the new rankings. And then
there was, yeah, and they really did not move ranking at all. They just basically just, yeah. And he explains that there are actually 25 teams in total at Blue Lock, and each team has a letter from B to Z. The higher the letter in the alphabet, the better the team, which, of course, makes our core team, our protagonist team, the worst team. He also mentions, too, that, like, each of the, like, five segments of the Blue Lock campus actually houses, like, I think five teams in that, like, section. Then the episode shifts focus, and we're suddenly kind of somewhere else, and we're witnessing an interview with a very famous Japanese soccer player who doesn't play for the Japan team, but he's a very, very, very successful soccer player named Itoshi Sai. And he's kind of a, like, you know.
But he basically says in this part, like, Japan sucks. That's why I play elsewhere. Yeah. I'm only here because my passport expired, type of thing. Like,
yeah, he came back.
He doesn't have a lot of faith. He had to renew his visa.
Like, he was even like, it was woe unto me. I was born in the wrong country.
Yeah.
He did say that. And it was also during his title card that it is revealed that he's considered one of the world's greatest 11 here. They're called the 11 heroes, the world's 11 greatest soccer players. Yeah. Again, 11 coming up again, that number again. So anyway, he gets up and he's like, all right, I'm done with this. I'm going to head out. And, you know, the interview is kind of following him around and stuff. And his like assistant is there with him. But he just happens to pass a conference room in that, I guess, hotel or wherever he's at. And there is a Japan Football Union press conference going on. And we see Henri there. And Henri is kind of giving this explanation of what Blue Lock is. And Ego is also giving a speech about the history of soccer, talking about how in the past, soccer was all forwards. They didn't have all these different positions and play styles. That was introduced later. The whole concept of teamwork introduced later. But in the core, at the very beginning, soccer or football was all just about getting the ball to the goal and everyone, you know, everyone for themselves, basically.
All for all.
I was kind of amused going back to the conference, And I think one of the reporters, because they were explaining what Blue Lock was to the public, you know, so it's, I guess, trying to not make it a secret underground dungeon program, but no, this is a thing we're doing to the public. Hey, guys, this is, a, you know, above the board, or at least to try and make it seem above the board. And I think one of the reporters was asking them, the way you're describing this program, you're going to ruin the careers, the lives of most of these candidates, everyone except the one who comes out on top. Are you okay with that? And Anomi's, I think, was something akin to, of course I am, of course, we should ruin all their lives, because Japan needs to win, that's all that matters. And I'm just thinking to myself, lady,
it's
you
like
are
I said, it's the most crazy important thing, is for Japan to win the World Cup.
In the very least, for Anri and Ego, they think it's the most important thing in the world. I do think that, like, these reporters and even some of the other higher members of the JFU are kind of, like, not that big about it, but, like, these two are just kind of insane about it.
Yeah, it's this episode really hammers that Anri and Ego are, like, basically have the same goal. They're not, like, the exact same type of personality, but I think even at a point, they kind of, like, are voicing the same thing at the same time, like a style where they're like, and the answer to this is Blue Lock, you know, my title drop sort of thing. But yeah, these two characters are both not the exact same personality, but both kind of obsessed with this.
Yeah. And then Sai is kind of walking by, and when he hears all this, he kind of gets interested. He's like, well, okay. And he kind of tells his assistant, he's like, you know what? Cancel my flight. I'm going to stay in Japan, and I want to watch and see what happens here. This is interesting to me. I'm kind of curious. And then the episode ends with a sort of sequence that takes place over the end credits, where we see Team Z is now finally put on soccer jerseys over their skin-tight uniforms. And they are on their way to a exhibition area where they're going to fight, or they're going to, I say fight, when they're going to have their first, it's going to be a fight, I'm sure, but they're going to have their first soccer match against another team, and it's going to be the next best, the Team X. And we see Team X arriving, and they're getting ready to be, to face off with Team X. I was going to say they were the second worst, but I guess they're not. I guess Team Y would be the second worst team. So.
Well, they said there's 25 teams.
Yeah.
There's no A. It's B through
there's
C.
There's
no A. Okay, I was wondering.
Yeah. And I'm pretty sure, I'm going to assume that Team A is going to be something that happens like in season three or something.
Team.
Yeah, and that's the episode. Oh, and I guess something we didn't mention too is that during the whole conversation with Bachira about the monster, I think that's when our protagonist starts to think, oh, well, maybe I have a monster. You know, maybe there's a monster in me.
Yeah, he kind of realizes, like, when I did that game of tag in the last episode, I kind of, like, lost control of myself, right? I didn't even realize what I was doing type of thing. I don't know. He didn't say that exactly, but kind of realizing that he, like, goes into, like, a different state of mind.
Is it, like, soccer stands? Is that what is happening here?
No, I think it might be, like, not Yu-Gi-Oh. What is it? Hikari no... Oh, it might be, like, Yu-Gi-Oh. I was thinking of Hikari no Go, where I think there's like a ghost possessing the main character, right?
Okay.
To do Go or something real well.
All right. So my overall thoughts are that, like, I think I am... How do I feel about this show? I keep wanting to compare it to Food Wars.
Yeah, it's similar.
I will say that, the thing is, it does feel very similar to Food Wars to me, except that I found the Food Wars characters generally more charismatic than this. So that's kind of where I'm at right now.
Food Wars definitely had more of a bit more of a comedy tint to it, but I get that comparison though.
Yeah, I think it's a valid comparison. That's kind of a sports archetype sort of show. Where in a world where blank is everything, and then you just go to extremes competing about whatever topic, all like take it to a comical extreme, but that's kind of the charm and humor of the series if it's done well.
All right. Well, that is Blue Lock. Let's move on to Tokyo Revengers. Tokyo Revengers, Episode 2, Resist. Episode opens up, and we see that Takamichi is at Naota's place. And Naota explains how he's been studying, or trying to figure out Takemichi's time travel powers for years now and years, and he has theories and explanations for how he thinks they might be able to use this ability to protect Hinata.
I mean, I think he's been studying more Tokyo Manji Gang, but obviously figuring out how the time travel power works is important as well. I feel like the whole Boar Smatters Tokyo Manji stuff.
That's what he does next, because he forces Takemichi to basically stay up all night learning everything he can about the Tokyo Manji Gang. He figures the more information that Takemichi has before he travels back in time about the gang, he can use that to his advantage when he's in the past. He says, the plan is this, Naota says, the plan is this, is that you need to go back in time. There are two main founders of this gang, a man named Sano and another one named Isaki, and you have to prevent them from ever meeting. If you prevent them from meeting, the Tokyo Machi gang won't become the way it is in the future, and that will ultimately save Hinata's life. And that is the plan. And so, like, Takemichi's like, okay, I got it. And they shake, boom, flash of light, and we cut to commercial, and that's, of course, him going back in time.
Right. I will mention, because they figured out that the way he was able to, Takemichi was able to get back to the present from the past was when he shook Naoto's hand in the past. So they theorized their handshake, they have some link that lets them activate and deactivate the powers. So that's how they get the idea to do the handshake, and of course, they were correct. That's how power gets triggered.
How does the train, the original train, factor into this?
Yeah, I do wonder too, like, they kind of like hand wave this a little bit, no pun intended, about the fact that, like, he's like, because you helped me and I am a part of an altered future that I am somehow now connected to your ability. I'm like, that seems so arbitrary to me. Like, it could have just been anything that triggered it. I mean,
I can't remember if they do so in the first season. I'm pretty sure they eventually explain it, but I can't remember if it was in the first season or not.
Okay. All right. Well, what they've got right now is vague at best. So, but they, I think so far are accurate. I mean, it definitely works, because of course he shakes his hand and goes back in time. When we come back from the commercial break, we see that he is suddenly finds himself 12 years ago in the past. Oh, one thing I want to quickly mention too, I don't want to forget this, is that Naota has also determined that the way that time traveling works is that you always go exactly 12 years into the past. So if it was January 3rd in the present day, you will go back to January 3rd 12 years ago. It's not like you can go to any specific day.
Time keeps moving along. You're just jumping back a certain amount, but time keeps moving forward nonetheless.
I feel like I've seen this kind of framing before, where there's like the interval between in the time travel is fixed, but I can't place it where I've seen this before.
Yeah, I can think of at least one movie that's done that, but
I assume every single variation of time travel has been tried by different authors across however.
Oh, of course. Yeah, but he just can't think of the one he's thinking of.
A specific one, you mean? But yeah,
yeah, I know there's one called Primer that works that way. But like, I do like this element, because it does create a sort of ticking clock scenario where, because events are, you know, the time is, you know, their ability to move back in time is kind of set to whenever they. He has a limited amount of time. Let's put it that way. They've kind of eliminated the sort of like, just go back and try again. Go back and try again. You can't do that.
Yeah,
You really have to commit to what you're going to do the day you go back. And the next time you go back is not going to be the same day. So you have to adjust. I like that. Okay. Anyway, he wakes up. He's in a fight club match. He's being forced, along with his other friends, to fight in these clubs, these fights that get bet on. And so forth. And of course, he's just taking a beating. He loses. The bigger, you were talking a lot last week, Seda, about how like these upper class middle schoolers. I mean, these 15-year-olds look like they're like 28-year-olds, and they're like 7 feet tall. Yeah. It's ridiculous.
I mean,
it's
just, I feel that's extremely common in like 90s and 80s manga. Obviously, this was not written that long ago. But to think of Jotaro, right? Jotaro Kujo, he's...
It doesn't mean I like it, though.
No, but I'm just saying it's not uncommon in these kind of delinquent stories that are all like gigantic for no goddamn reason.
The only saving grace is that this guy, I'm sure, was held back several years or something.
And I think even Takemichi remarks at one point in this episode, like this guy's a middle schooler, like kind of like kind of emphasizing that, like, yeah, this guy is not just any middle schooler. He's apparently, like, even in universe, a huge middle schooler who smokes, apparently. Did middle schooler smoke in 2005?
Like, are we sure he's not late on his mortgage payments?
No, it probably has.
That's actually something I was wondering, though. Like, do middle schoolers in Japan, like, any of them, like, smoke cigarettes in 2005? Like, there is quite a lot of smoking. That seems weird.
I don't know. In 2005, I don't know. Yeah,
I know they're touching about showing kids smoking in their media. I'm not sure if that's maybe a reaction to it was like a problem in real life. I don't know exactly, but it could certainly have been a thing.
I'll just say I wasn't expecting to see that many middle schoolers smoking. It wasn't just one guy. There was a handful. Yeah. So whatever.
They're delinquents, right? So they're not arrows.
Well, anyway, it gets censored a lot, but whatever. So these upperclassmen, let's call them that, upperclassmen thugs that they are now underlings of, they're giving them grief. They beat up on Takemichi because he lost the fight. But then Takemichi's thinking to himself, like, I got to get information about these two heads, this Sano and Isaki. And so he asks the main upperclassman, his name is Yamamoto, and he's like, hey, do you know Sano? I want to meet him. And then this guy gets real mad. He's like, get me my bat. And he ends up spending, like, I don't know, half an hour just hitting Takemichi with the bat. And he's like, if you ever say Sano to me again, I will kill you.
One thing I was a little bit confused about, just a little bit, was like, oh, I guess this gang, what is the gang called? Tokyo Manji?
The Tokyo Machi gang.
I wrote it down. Tokyo Manji is what I wrote, or Toma Manji, for short. They call it Toma for short. But I guess they like exist in the past, so it's not like a newly formed gang. And this guy is already the leader of it. I was kind of under the impression like this guy becomes the leader of this gang in the present time, but I guess he was already the leader, or at least one of them was back then.
I think he's the boss of that character, but that doesn't necessarily mean he's the big boss. I think that's the
thing. He's an underling of, I think, the two bigger ones is what's going on here.
Like, there's a hierarchy, but that doesn't necessarily mean he's at the very top, the Sano fellow at this point in time.
Yeah. I got the impression in the dialogue of this episode that the people that our protagonists' friends are working under are not the top of the gang. They're like underlings of that gang as well. So.
Yeah, the underlings of underlings of underlings, but yeah.
Yeah. And again, I just think to myself, it's like, what a wonderful life you've chosen for yourself, man. Isn't this great being a gang member? Like, let's just get beat by fucking baseball bats all day. That sounds wonderful.
I mean, this is why he left, right? So
leave now. Well, I mean, again, in the past, obviously, he can't do it now. He has a mission, but he shouldn't have gotten this far.
Yeah, but he did leave. That's his whole thing of his backstory.
He doesn't leave for a while.
Well, sure. I think it's a couple. I think he graduates high school and then Splitsville.
Yeah. It's like the moment someone decides they're going to break a bat out on you and they tell you to your face they're going to kill you, change the situation. Don't stay there.
One part about this episode that kind of didn't really land for me just because it was so like truncated was like the scene in the bathroom. Which is kind of a weird place for it, but he's like, actually, my friends are pretty cool. And he's like, are they?
Yeah.
Are they?
No, they're not.
Well, in the last episode, he actually was kind of like, kind of almost muttering to himself, like, these are my friends? Like, these guys? And then, like, this episode, almost like he has this, like, realization, like, actually, they're pretty cool. And, like, what they actually talked about in that scene was that long-haired kid, whose name I forget, was like, I'm going to get into a fight, even though I'm not, like, a fighter. And they're like, you know, they like showed him support, I guess. But it's just like, then he's like, actually, my friends are pretty cool. And I'm like, really? I don't know about that. I mean, we haven't seen enough of them.
I think this frame of cool was that everyone supports each other, not that they're
smart. They could do a better job. You know what? Here's a better way of supporting each other. Don't be in a gang. Do that.
I mean,
I'm not going to get over this. I'm sorry. It's frustrating. I just watch these people make these decisions, and I just can't understand it. All right. After the third beating of the day that Takemichi received, What a wonderful life. He's walking down the street and he's bloodied and people are looking at him weird. And he's like, I can't do this. I'm going to have to go find Naoto and shake his hand. I got to stop this. I can't take this anymore. I'm not going to be strong enough to do this mission. But he then runs into Hinata on his way. And he they have a nice little moment here in conversation. He accidentally calls her Hina, which is, you know, very informal. And she kind of blushes and says she likes it because he's never called her that before. And they sort of vow to protect each other. And it's like, I'm going to protect you. You're going to protect me. It's just a really nice scene.
If I was more cynical than I am, she does kind of mention a few times, like, if I was a guy, I'd be stronger. And like,
there was
I'm kind of thinking to myself, like, is that misogynistic where he's like, I'm only weak because I'm a girl? But that might be too cynical a look at it.
Ask Kuina.
Oh, yeah.
Is that from Anji Token? Or is that what you're
for? No, that's from One Piece. That's
One Piece.
Oh, right. Okay. I think
yeah, I mean, like, named that in another show. But I do appreciate that she said, like, I'm going to protect you. And she's not just, you know, please protect me type of thing. Like, she's trying to reciprocate it. But she does, like, mention a few times, like, I'd be stronger if I was a guy. Which is, I don't know, maybe true. Just, like, biologically.
I think we have to frame it in the... We were just mentioning how all the men in the show look like they're linebackers who are, you know, have mortgages.
Yeah.
I guess in that context, it might help if she had, like, two more feet and, like, 30 more pounds of muscle on her, I guess. And it's obviously not a supernatural show, so, like... I mean, it is in the sense of time travel, but not in the sense that people have super strength or whatever. So you're kind of right, but also the delinquents in the show are like gigantic, so I wouldn't want to fight them either. And I'm like,
I mean, I don't want her fighting. Like, if she's just going to get beat up. But
No. And I think, I mean, I'm not going to go too much into it, but like, it does surprise me sometimes when I hear women say these things, like in real life. And I'm like, but I think we take for granted sometimes that, like, I mean, humans are humans, and it's not disparaging for me to say that it is a kind of scientific thing that generally women don't have the upper body strength that men often have. And so I think women often even see themselves as being incapable of fighting a man. That's why we have, that's why our society is a lot of the way it is. I don't necessarily believe that with like 100%, like, oh yeah, every woman is weaker than a man. I'm never going to say that.
Obviously, that's not true.
It's not true, but I do think that on average, it would not be surprising for a woman to find herself in a difficult situation where she's facing off a man who has greater upper body strength, and that's going to put her at a disadvantage. So I kind of get what she's saying.
And that's kind of similarly, I've heard women, like real women, say that they kind of have to treat any man they don't know as like potentially dangerous. And exactly. not saying that they are, but just like, you know, there's a chance that any man I do not know, if they had poor intentions, could overpower me. And like, just that's just a realization of something that could happen.
I think that's what Hinata is kind of alluding to here.
Right. That's extremely true. Like, that's something I've heard a lot of, and you see a lot of that. It's unfortunately extremely true. Like, they just they have to. And also, Hinata herself, she doesn't know martial arts. She is pretty small. Like,
She does say she knows karate, actually.
Yeah. Does she? Okay.
Yeah, she does. She does even does like a move. She kind of shows off a little there, yeah.
Anyways, okay, more broadly, like, I think that's not necessarily my argument, but I was just kind of wondering as she was talking here, like, I wonder how people take to this character, but we need to see more of her. But actually, more broadly, I'm kind of curious, like, what type of character Hinata is in the show, because, like, we've seen her a few times, and she's, like, clearly, like, the goal is to save her life, but I'm kind of curious just the way this show is constructed, like, to what extent can she participate? Like, do they figure out her...
You're basically asking if she's a fully developed, well-fleshed-out character or, like, an object, basically, right?
Right, exactly. So, and I'm wondering, like, once they solve... Like, I know this show is 3 seasons in so far, and, like, I'm curious, like, do they, like, solve this conundrum of her death, and then after that she is like just present as a character? I don't know.
Yeah, well, I will tell you this, I mean, so far her position in the show is to be a sounding board and a conscience for our protagonist. She's playing the role of the sensible, reasonable, average person to a person who lives a life of a thug. And I think that's where that's the role she plays in the story.
And also, like, in this episode, like, Takemichi was literally about to give up, and meeting her again was the reason why he didn't.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, I can't give up on her.
She has a courage to her own way that inspires him. So now I'm going to go on, because one thing I want to correct earlier, I said that the main bad guy was named Yamamoto. I'm wrong. Yamamoto is the long-haired friend of theirs. The name of the big, giant, hulking middle schooler, his name is Kiyomasa. So anyway, the next day, Yamamoto is placed into a situation where he has to fight because he's in one of the arranged fights that day. But before he gets to actually do the fight, Takemichi decides he's going to take a stand. He comes walking down the stairs and he calls out Kiyomasa and he's like, "Yo, I want to fight you. Let's skip the piddly battles. Let's have a real challenge." And he challenges the big guy. I think the ultimate point of this scene is and where we're going is that he's getting the courage now because of the conversation he had had with his girlfriend. He realizes, I can't pussyfoot around anymore. If I'm going to solve this, I've got to be stronger than I ever was. So now he's going to directly challenge his superior. So,
yeah, I think he realizes that if he just plays things out exactly as he did back when he was originally this age, all that's going to happen is going to get his ass whooped and eventually run away, and nothing's going to fix. So he has to throw some big swings to really shake things up. So he's just, you know, throw down the gauntlet, get in there. If I need things to change, so I have to change in the most dramatic way possible.
I like that he kind of says to himself, and you can hear in his inner monologue, he's like, "Well, it's too late now. I've got to commit. I just have to do it.
Yeah, I'm doing this. Yeah,
it's going to happen.
Yeah, no changing your mind now. Yeah,
right.
Yeah, like it shows just a hair. It just shows a hair of uncertainty. Like he definitely had the courage to, like, you know, do this to begin with, but he's not like insane about it. He's like, I, you know, kind of have to, kind of hesitant, kind of scared, but he has to do it. So
I don't have high hopes for him, judging by the tone of this show, but it would give me great pleasure to see him wipe the floor with this Kiyomasa character, because I just want to see these, like, super cocksure thug guys get their comeuppance. But knowing this show, he'll probably just lose. So I don't know. We'll see. Tokyo Revengers. Yeah, It's all right. I kind of like when Hinata's on screen, I get more invested in the story. But like, time travel isn't a big part of this show. It's more just about like these thugs dealing with thug life. That's kind of the thing. So,
what, time travel is a big part of the show? What do you mean? Because it's not a big show.
Well, just that, I don't know. It's the mechanism by which the story is being told, but I don't know. I just feel like 90% of the episode is just watching these guys go through a shitty thug life and we have to watch them suffer.
I mean, I guess I'll say, like, as the story moves on, things change in the future. I mean, we already had instance where Takemichi's actions, like, Naoto died in the first run of this, remember? And so Takemichi's
I'm sure he's going to go back and it'll be different. I know that's going to come. I get that. I'm just saying that, like, this episode was just thug life stuff. That's all.
Forever.
All right. Well, let's move on to One Piece. One Piece, episode 764, To My Buds, Sanji's Farewell Note. So now we get to find out what he wrote on that note, but that's in the last 10 seconds.
He wrote Dick Butt. It's a drawing.
Anyway, we get a scene where Beji is explaining just how powerful Big Mom is. That's kind of what I wrote down there. It's just like,
yeah, it says like no one betrays Big Mom, and it like shows she can do whatever she wants, and it even shows like a kind of a graphic where it's like, here's the ocean and it's being totally like consumed by Big Mom. Like, okay. Yeah.
I think this was an answer to Sanji's question, is like, how did you learn that information? And that's when Beji's like, you don't understand, Big Mom's an emperor. She has so much power. Anyway, Sanji then kind of goes over and gets up, walks over, and he gives Nami this sort of note that he's written. And he kind of tells her, he says, "I've never meant to hide anything from my friends," he tells her.
Yeah, he even says, like, "I wasn't expecting to have to deal with my past, but it came up and caught up with me." And, like, I believe him. Like, if I was in that position where I thought I left that life behind me, there's nothing to share, it's not part of me anymore, I don't care about it, why even bring it up? Yeah, like, I wouldn't say he was hiding anything, he's just like, it doesn't matter anymore. So I believe him.
Right.
In that sense.
Yeah, yeah, he just, exactly.
What would happen? Like, oh, by the way, guys, I'm actually a son of a family in the North Blue. I'm not part of that life anymore. You know, like, what would he have said if he wouldn't have? Yeah, anyways, that's the point. I believe him, so...
Yeah, well, it is true to his character. He doesn't talk about his past. Mm. Anyway, he's like, "But I'm not going to let my friends get hurt." And he just kicks Brooke, Nami, and Chopper out the door.
I think he tosses them, actually, right? Doesn't he, like,
yeah, he, like, toss he them like up? Hugs them. And for a moment, it's like it seems like, you know, like an embrace. You know, like, not okay. Something that Sanji would do. And then he, like, from this sort of, like, embrace, he, like, chucks them.
Yep. And they all get big again once they're outside. And then
he grabs the gun and then he holds Caesar hostage. Poor Caesar.
Yeah.
I'm joking. Poor Caesar.
It's kind of great to watch Caesar just constantly be like, "No! Why me?"
And then Sanji's actually relatively observant here in two ways. One, he says, like, you know, "I know Caesar's important to you, so I know you're not going to threaten him. Or I know you're not going to, you know, risk his well-being. But also, I realized that my wanted poster said only alive, so you can't kill me either. So, like, you can't, you don't want me to hurt Caesar, and you can't hurt me either. So what are you going to do about it, huh?" Kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so. If he's going to get married off, you can't marry off a corpse, so.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Then Benji kind of gets scared for a moment. He's like, "Oh, wait a minute. I sense something. And then we kind of cut outside, and we realize that Cat Viper has arrived, and he's standing right behind Benji. And
menacingly,
and he's like, "Yeah, he's like, what are you doing, Gaara?
Why is Peckham's full of bullets?"
Yeah, why is he full of bullets? The Benji lies, and he says, "He's like, oh, I didn't shoot him." And he's like, "No, I don't believe you, whatever." And then he's like, "I gotta go." And then he turns into a tank and starts driving away.
Very cool.
They totally could have caught up to him if they wanted to, but they just didn't try.
Yeah, they kind of do get. The other Straw Hats kind of do look inside Benji briefly as he's about to take off, and they kind of see Sanji in there, a little version of him, and he kind of looks up and he just smiles and he's like, "Take care."
Yeah, kind of like the "don't worry about me" type of smile, even though they're going to worry.
It's like, "I'm fine." I'll leave you with a smile. Mm. And then Nami's really sad. We get this sad scene where she's just crying and stuff, and then she opens up the note, and it just says...
Well, actually, I don't think she intentionally opens up the note. The note kind of, like, falls and just, like, opens up on the floor.
That's right.
And I'm sure they read it, but it, like, you know, just kind of stylistically here, it, like, opens up on its own, and then we hear Sanji kind of narrating what he said.
Yeah.
His message was, I gotta go see a girl, I'll be back soon. Something like that.
Yeah. "I gotta go see a woman, I'll be back." And then we get the commercial. And back in the present, we're, again, on our way to Cat Viper still. And, you know.
And Luffy's like, "We got to take on Big Mom."
Yeah. Kind of. Luffy learns about the wedding here as well. He's like, "Whoa, wedding." And they kind of argue. I think, what was it? Robin's kind of like, "Well, maybe he's really leaving, you know." They kind of think he might be leaving for a moment there. And then Robin also says, she's like, "Vin Smoke, I feel like I've heard that somewhere."
But it's vague. Yeah. I actually kind of appreciate this. I kind of appreciate that she doesn't know. I feel like a lot of storytelling in this sort of like, with this sort of fashion, they're like, let me explain to you. I feel like a lot of exposition in storytelling, it's like you'll have a character who'd be like, "Oh, let me explain to you everything I know and give you all the information that the watchers or readers need at this point." But she's just like, "Actually, I don't really know this family," mm-hmm. which is like, I'm thankful for that she's not just an all-knowing whatever.
Yeah. If anyone would, it'd be her. But yeah, it sounds like she kind of heard the name, but she can't place it.
And, you know, you can't expect any random person to know every single important family in the world, right? It makes the world feel big. So, which it is.
Yeah. And then Zoro is being very gruff, and he's like, look, here's the deal.
I actually appreciate that Zoro kind of breaks this down of all characters.
Everybody's like mad at him. He's like, no, I'm going to keep it real.
So we took out Punk Hazard, and then Doflamingo got mad. And then we took out Doflamingo in the Smile Factory, and who do you think is going to get angry at us next? It's Kaido. So, like, he's, like, laying it all out.
He's like, we're going to have to take on two emperors now. We're going to take on both Big Mom and Kaido.
And he also mentions in this moment, like, the fact that Sanji said be back soon makes him, like, less worried that he's going to do something, like, crazy or dramatic.
Or leave the team or whatever, yeah.
Yeah.
Because that was the big fear. They're fearing like, oh, well, maybe Sanji will join the Big Mom Pirates to distance himself from us.
To protect
us.
You know,
that was, to protect us. Right. Anyway, he's like, we're going to have to fight Big Mom and all this other stuff. And then Luffy, in a surprising suggestion, says, well, maybe we can just sneak in. We can sneak into Big Mom's land and we'll just ask Sanji himself what his plan is. So Luffy, in a uncharacteristic move, is suggesting rather than just straight up going to Big Mom's territory and fighting her straight on, they're going to sneak in.
Well,
I thought Chopper had that idea, wasn't it?
No, Luffy does say that, but he kind of has to relent a little bit. I think, if I remember correctly, Luffy's like, let's go get Big Mom. And it's like, and I think, what's his name? Patrick Seitz, that character.
Of course, Frankie.
I think even Frankie is. I think Frankie is like, well, there's no way we can take on Big Mom, and then Luffy's like, well, we can sneak in.
Yeah.
So he kind of has to relent a little bit.
That's true.
Oh. Pretty sure wasn't Chopper in the mix there. I feel like it was.
I'm positive that Luffy says we can sneak in. I'm positive he says that. Although he does have to. They kind of have to like reel him in a little bit for him to suggest it. So it's a little bit in character that it's not like he immediately suggests let's sneak in.
That's true.
It's kind of like his backup.
I don't remember that part, but it does coming back to me that that seems more realistic that he would do that.
So again, he's like, let's go get Big Mom, and then Frankie's like, there's no way we can take on Big Mom, and then Luffy's like, well, let's just sneak in.
Oh, there's one other thing too, and then they end the episode with it's like, well, we don't even know how to get there, and then Luffy says, well, I know somebody who does.
Or Brooke, and then that's when Brooke says that.
Or Brooke does. Brooke knows somebody who does, and that's when they cuts to be continued. So,
which has to be Peckham's, right? So he's still alive, even though he got
That's kind of weird. Like Brooke was really teasing it out, but I assume it's just Toei trying to pad out the episode because it was kind of very obvious.
Like, who else would
it be? Right.
Who else would have insight on Big Mom?
It just had to be Toei padding because otherwise the way that episode dragged on at the end made no sense.
How is Peckham still alive?
One piece. And no one dies.
Unless
it's a flashback.
Again, maybe the weakest. I'm exaggerating, but I'm going to say the weakest weapon in One Piece is a bullet. You know, although we've seen characters get shot, so I guess. All right, and that is One Piece. Sanji is gone.
If Sanji were to shoot Caesar, would it even work? I guess it would if he had the sea stone cuffs on.
Yeah, I think it's circumstantial.
I was thinking, if Sanji were to shoot Caesar, wouldn't the bullet like go right through him because he's gas?
This is the only reason Caesar has been along with the crew and hasn't just like murdered everyone in their sleep, right?
Well, the other reason is they have his heart.
That's true.
Or they did. They do. I don't wonder where it is now.
Well, Sanji has it. So, does Sanji still have it?
He must. He must have it in his back pocket or something. Or unless they took it from him, they might have taken it from him because they had him chained up.
Well, it'll come back. It has to.
Oh, yeah, it has to. Only Law can restore it, so. All right. Well, that is it for the rundown this week. Does anything jump out to you as a flavor alert, or do we even need to do it?
Play flavor alert.
Potential award nominations.
Did you put Eagle's name on the name category last week?
No, we can do that.
Yeah, why not?
Sure.
It is very on the nose.
Yep. I'll add that.
I think for like things like, obviously like best character and best voice and whatnot for these two new shows, I think we need to give them a little bit more time.
Yeah.
Two episodes is not enough.
Yeah. Like there's a couple of character voices that I think are like, that seems pretty good, but let's give them more time.
Fair enough. Yeah. We're still in the early days of these new shows.
Character design, Lily Barrow, Angel Form.
No.
I'm joking.
Yeah, I know. Unfortunately, we don't have a worse character design.
What the fuck is this nomination?
Yeah.
Wait, I thought Purunga, what was the hand guy's name? Pepperita Purunga?
Pernitas.
Yeah. Like,
I remember there being like five continents in a row.
Right. I remember the joke Grex made about how you have to fight one parent member of the villain squad who is the what the fuck is that? Is there like now two what the fuck is that members of the squad?
Yeah, I guess. Well, I guess I'm just trying to think. So Pernita is pretty much taken care of, right? Mm-hmm. Now, the Lily Barrow is pretty much taken care of. So I guess we have like the Valkyrie man. Like, what's he up to? What's he going to transform
you'll
into?
See in a, you, we'll start that battle before the season ends. But
oh, okay. Like, they got to take care of him eventually. And who else am I missing? Runaway guy. Okay.
Yeah, next episode's going to be the... The Soul Ritter, the Stern Ritters versus Stern Ritters stuff.
Oh, Flame Guy versus Jugrum.
Yeah, Bazby versus
Jugrum. Yeah, we see that in the opening, so it makes sense. I mean, like if you can just watch the opening and you get to see how what we haven't seen yet.
I was going to mention this, that like the shot in the opening, which is very cool, when she Nanao like turns the sword and it glows, and I'm like, oh, now I know what that means.
Yeah, we've been saying that, like, we see Nemu in the opening, she's gonna do something, and she did, and then she exploded.
Yep.
Nanao's in the opening, she's gonna do something, and she did. And then there's like a part in the opening where it shows, this is not maybe that interesting, but it shows Bazby with like a big like flame sword arm going after Jugrum. Like, okay, that's the next episode, basically. That's
probably next episode. So. Yeah, exactly.
Oh, just to briefly touch upon Nemu, Seda was having trouble remembering.
Like I said with Nanao, I do not. If Nemu was shown earlier, it went at one in one ear and out the other. I did not remember.
Remember the fight about versus Saizo Paulo Grons? I think the eighth Espada, the scientist guy?
Evidently not.
Okay, well, no. Nemu and Mayuri show up in that fight and they basically finish it. So, like, there was a moment where I think a Nemu attack and then Saizo like impregnates her or like, eats her. It's really fucking weird. And he like, it's fucking weird. But that was the other moment I was kind of touching back on. Not that she got exploded before, but that there was a moment where like she was trying to use herself as a weapon. But then like Saizo did a Uno reverse and it was kind of really fucking weird. And yeah,
okay,
but that's what I was referring to.
Yeah, you have pretty good memory on the show. I do not.
And I have none. I mean, aside from what was shown like in the final season.
Anyways, I don't think I have any other flavor alerts. It's going to be weird for like stuff like best fight in like soccer. Like,
yeah, I wonder how we're going to deal with that.
Dog fights.
Good question. And none of the fights in Tokyo Revengers are good fights. They're just people getting beaten.
Does Takemichi eventually get like time stop powers where he can like...
The world? No, he does not get the world. Sure, that.
I'm joking, but yeah,
he does not get the world. He does not get made it from heaven.
Oh, you know, one other thing I want to mention.
Does
about
not get
the,
diamond they, like what was the guy in part four? Diamond Dust or something, that ability to make a bomb that reverses time.
If you don't remember, then I don't.
No, Bites the Dust. There we go. That's the ability from Killer Queen, Bites the Dust. Yeah, he doesn't get Bites the Dust either.
One thing that they did reveal, though, in this episode that I thought was kind of interesting was, so, you know, they make a big deal about, oh, if you go back to, you know, if it's January 3rd, you go back to January 3rd. But what's interesting, though, is that it's not the same time. Like, it was nighttime when he left, and then it was, like, the daytime when he arrived.
Don't think about it.
But it gets even weirder because, like, he ends up spending more time there. Like, it ends up being the next day before he even goes back.
Yeah, and, like, and, well, he hasn't even returned present time yet.
Right, exactly. That's what I'm saying.
That dude. But, I'm wondering.
Yeah.
Because, like, when he returned first, he found himself, like, was it in the hospital or, like, in, now it's his apartment?
Hospital.
In the hospital. But, time had moved forward and back in the present. So, like, when he came back, time had moved forward.
But I guess, like, when he when he from Naota's perspective, does he just like disappear from the world and then Naota just kind of has to like sit there twiddling his thumbs? Like, I wonder when he's going to reappear again and just like just
reappear. Yeah, we haven't seen that side of it yet. Yeah,
like, we'll see how that works, I suppose. Because we've only seen it once and he just like appeared in the hospital and we intentionally were missing out on
something. I thought it was going to be more like Groundhog Day or something where it's like once it reached midnight, he just is forced to go back to the present. But it seems like he can stay there.
Yeah, that's a mechanic they'll have to like detail eventually, I suppose.
But he just sort of can, at the moment, from what we've seen, he can just stay there until he shakes hands again. I mean, could he stay there for a year? Maybe. I don't know. We'll see.
He even kind of mentioned that like this is sort of like a second life. And like, could he just live out a second life and just never touch Naota's hand and just he's 14 years old again or whatever?
You know what he could do? He could take his girlfriend and be like, come with me to Paris.
Yeah, let's just go somewhere else. Although, knowing time travel stories, she would inevitably, something bad would happen.
Sports almanac back with him or something, right? Write down all the numbers and start betting and then, make fortune.
Exactly.
I think we've all seen enough time travel stories that if you try to do the easy out, like, let's just go somewhere else and avoid the problem altogether, something terrible would happen, whether she would die anyways or the timeline would get all screwed up or something.
Like a can event or whatever, or singularity point, or like a different story is called things or something.
Yeah, some stories where you can only make minor adjustments to time, and there's other stories where, like you're saying, like it's inevitable. You might prevent the bad thing that happens, but you don't predict the other bad thing that could happen. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, let's wrap up the episode. That is it for episode 462. We will be back next week for another episode of the same lineup. Thank you very much for being here, Seda.
Yep, no problem.
And thank you, Crocodile.
My pleasure.
And we will see you again next week. And until then, later.